From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Biancooley, in for Terry Gross.
I gotta say, things are going really well for me right now, and surprisingly, I'm okay with it. I mean, the podcast is killing, I'm playing bigger rooms.
That's comic Mark Maron from the second season of his IFC series Maron, which began yesterday. Maron hosts the popular podcast WTF, and his memoir, Attempting Normal, recently came out in paperback. Today, he talks about comedy, fear, anxiety, dread, and his mother.
She goes, you know, Mark, you know, when you were a baby, I don't think I knew how to love you. And I'm like, all right, well, there's a missing piece to the puzzle. I guess I can cancel my therapy now.
Also, David Edelstein reviews God's Pocket, starring Philip Seymour Hoffman in one of his final roles. And I'll review two new TV programs, Showtime's Penny Dreadful and NBC's remake of Rosemary's Baby. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Marc Maron, is not only a very funny comic, his podcast WTF is the go-to place for interviews with comics. A lot of great comics have been in his garage where he records his podcast interviews. And his TV series, titled Maron, began season 2 last night on the IFC network. He plays a character based on himself named Marc Maron. Here's a clip from the first episode of the new season. He's talking on the phone to his agent.
So there's interest in me, huh? Well, that's good, right?
The podcast is catching on. You've got fans in high places. People at Fox Studios, Sony, America's Funniest Videos.
You're on fire. There's a bit of buzz. We're going to get you a chat show.
Please call it a talk show.
Whatever. It's thrilling. There's just one problem.
What's that?
A lot of people think you're an ass.
Oh, come on. Don't they listen to my podcast? Who says that, those pieces of shit?
Right, completely unfounded. But right now, we need to prove that you can play nicely with others.
Yeah? How are we going to do that?
You've heard of The Walking Dead?
Well, there's a chat show that runs after it called Talking Dead.
I know. It's hosted by that comedian, Chris Hardwick.
Is there a problem between you two?
He might be one of those people that thinks I'm an asshole.
Last year, Marc Maron published his memoir called Attempting Normal. It's now in paperback. Terry Gross spoke to him then, and they began with a clip from the very first episode of his TV series, Maron.
Things are going pretty well for me right now, but that's a problem because when things are going well, that means there's a voice in my head saying, you're going to screw it up. You're going to screw it up, Mark, just over and over again. I just wish that voice were louder than the voice screaming, let's screw it up. A few years ago, I was planning on killing myself in my garage, and now I'm doing the best thing I've ever done in my life in that same garage. It's a podcast. You know what a podcast is? I've been on Conan O'Brien like 47 times, and you don't know who I am, right?
That's Marc Maron from the start of his new IFC TV series. Maron, welcome to Fresh Air. Marc Maron, welcome back.
Thank you.
I love that opening because it sounds like, you know, as I was watching it for the first time, I thought, oh, I guess he's being interviewed by a reporter who's not on screen. And then we realize, no, you're just trying to impress the veterinarian who's treating your cat and you're thinking about how you're going to hit on her afterwards.
Yes.
So I love it how at the same time you're trying to impress her and then you're almost accusing her of not knowing who you are.
Yeah, it's tricky. You know, it's a tricky thing to be charming and completely insecure at the same time.
So I don't usually start interviews with questions about suicide attempts, but since you bring it up in the very, very start of your show, you say you once tried to kill yourself in the garage that you are now using for your podcasts. So since you brought it up,
yeah,
why did you try to kill yourself?
Well, I think I should be clear that I didn't try to kill myself. The deal was is that I thought about it a lot. You know, it was a difficult point in my life. My career had sort of hit a wall. I was in the middle of a horrible divorce. You know, I wasn't getting much stand-up work, and I really didn't know what to do. And when you invest half your life into a creative field, into a dream like being a stand-up, when you all of a sudden, when you're in your late 40s or mid-40s and everything goes wrong, there's no plan B in place anymore. You have that moment where you're like, all right, well, I could always, and there's just nothing there. And in my mind, because of pride and being brokenhearted, I just would, you know, fantasize about killing myself. I didn't see any other way out in my brain. I don't know that I really wanted to, but I found it relaxing to know that I could, if necessary. It's sort of the spiritual reprieve of a faithless person. And so I really don't want to portray myself as someone who was like, you know, planning a way or actually trying to commit suicide. I just had a lot of suicidal ideation going on.
So you found it kind of relaxing to know that there could be a way out if you wanted one.
Yeah, the ultimate way out. It's just the way my brain worked. I think there's a selfishness to it all, obviously. But in my mind, you know, I didn't have a wife. I didn't have children. I didn't have a career. I think a lot of that kind of stuff is just really, it's self-pity. And it sometimes you get stuck on that and stuck in it. And it can sort of become depression. And that's where I was at that point when I started the podcast.
So your podcast now, which is really popular and talked about, you do that from your garage. Has it helped you as a comedian to talk comedy with a lot of comics in the podcast?
I don't know if it's helped me as a comic, but I do know that it helped me as a human. I was at a place in my life where I'd gotten very cynical. I'd lost a lot of hope for my comedy and everything else. And I really feel that, you know, I was no longer able to really appreciate other people's stories. I'd lost my ability to really kind of listen and enjoy the company of other people. And I think that when I look back at the podcast, it was really a way of me reconnecting with like-minded people, with people I'd sort of known for years, and learning how to sort of talk about problems and issues with friends and peers. And because of that, you know, my joy came back. My ability to laugh came back. My ability to sort of listen and engage emotionally with someone else's story came back. It just sort of it brought me back into the world of the living emotionally. But as far as comedy goes, I think that to be validated and to become relevant in my community helped me on all levels.
So you have a really terrific WTF podcast with Conan. And you write about that podcast in your memoir. So you write that you were really uncomfortable about Conan coming over to your garage. You'd been on his show a lot of times. You really admired him. Why were you so uncomfortable about him coming over to the garage to do the podcast?
Well, there's still a thing about, you know, he's a TV guy. He's a big TV star. And, you know, I always looked at him as the guy who would let me on his show. And we had this rapport on the show and there was respect there. And I knew he was a busy guy and a hard worker. And he's a very intense dude. And it was just really the fact that even though I'd done his show so many times over so many years, that I don't know his life. I don't know him. It's really that weird separation between, you know, what we get as fans or as coworkers of somebody who has a public personality and what you really know about him. So when he was coming over, I was sort of overwhelmed and grateful that he was going to come, but there was a lot of insecurity in it. It's like, now he's going to see my house. He's probably going to use my bathroom. He's going to judge my couch. You know, there was a lot of things going through my mind. So it was the casualness that was intimidating to me, you know.
So I'm going to ask you to do a short reading about what the interview was like and what it was like afterwards. So this is Marc Maron reading from his new book, Attempting Normal, about his interview with Conan O'Brien in Maron's garage for his WTF podcast.
Once we got behind the mics, it all flowed very easily. It wasn't about what was said. It was the fact that this was the first time I had really talked to him. He told me stuff that wasn't part of his public narrative, and I got to know him a bit. It was emotional for me because I had always wanted to be his pal in some way, and even more so because he was doing the podcast, and that meant I was doing something relevant. I felt proud. I wanted to do a good job because I respected him, and in some way, it was a turning of the tables. When we finished, we went back into the house and Conan was just sort of lingering. He was looking at my stuff on my table, on my walls, and it was awkward again. Not in a bad way, but we were both back to our roles. I was a guy whom he let appear on his show and had a good television rapport with, and he was a star who, in my mind, had better things to do. That might not have been the case. We have a history, and we had just had this great talk, and now I knew I couldn't say, okay, we'll talk tomorrow, or let me know when you want me to come by the house for dinner, or anything real friends say to each other. It literally got to the point where I was wondering how to get him out of my house because I didn't know what to do or say. It was time for him to go back to his life and me to get on with mine.
I love that part because I really relate to that feeling that after you've had this like really personal conversation and then the mics get turned off, you sometimes have like no idea what to say. And it's such a contrast because, you know, you could be so personal and intimate in the interview and in real life, it's so awkward.
Yeah, it can be. And I don't really know how to deal with it sometimes. I've had people linger and it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's that moment where you realize, right, we don't know each other's lives. We're not really part of each other's lives. And because of what we're doing for this show, you know, we've just really connected in a deep way. And I'm very sensitive to that. I mean, I've had experiences with people in my life that literally lasted maybe 5 minutes and had such a lasting impression on me that I feel bonded to those people. I think that's a lot of what, you know, propels some of the interviews on my show. But, you know, John Hamm hung out after he did my show and sat on the deck with me and my girlfriend. And who else? Like, you know, when I interviewed Jonathan Winters at his home before he passed away, you know, he wanted to go out to lunch. And it was an honor, but there's just a moment where you're like, is this happening? Is this my life? Is this okay? I mean, is he comfortable? He must be. He asked me to go with him. It's very tricky.
I thought now we can hear an excerpt of the podcast you did with Conan O'Brien. And in this part, you've been talking about how difficult it was for Conan when he first started hosting Late Night back in the 90s, because he'd mm-hmm. never done that kind of work before. People weren't used to seeing him on camera. He wasn't used to being on camera. He was getting bad reviews. There was a lot of public criticism. So here's him talking a little bit about that period.
I probably have a Catholic need to suffer. That helps me. So... So the trials and tribulations that I went through in 93, 94 probably was my way of paying whatever dues I felt I needed to pay to keep that show. And then once I had suffered enough, there's part of me that was like, all right.
Yeah.
And now I could move on to another level. And that's probably what happened.
So that really did have that, Catholicism has that kind of effect. Like, because I have no familiarity with it. But the idea of suffering that's part of life is really something that's plowed into your brain.
Yeah, it gets into your DNA. And I'm really trying very hard in the last couple of years.
Like you're not doing it right if you're not suffering?
Yeah, I'm trying to... And you know what? My escape from that was always comedy. Comedy was always something that I could get into a zone and you can have a really good time and people can really be laughing. And I would think later on, wait a minute, people liked that and I was enjoying myself. And I was in the moment and I wasn't self-conscious. So comedy was always my escape valve. And then the tricky thing was I turned it into a career. And when you turn the thing you love into a career, you're playing with fire.
That was Conan O'Brien talking to Mark Maron for Mark Maron's WTF broadcast. So, Mark Maron, do you relate to that? Those are some nice insights there from Conan, but do you relate to the idea of suffering being an inspiration?
I relate more to the fact that, comedy is a relief and comedy is a release and comedy is the only way that we can feel present and lose ourselves. I find over time that I don't enjoy suffering, and there's something comforting and sort of predictable about the way your brain works around your own troubles. But I have found that I'm more of an anxiety-ridden person, that I experience a tremendous amount of dread and fear and panic. I think I've been mischaracterized a bit as a guy that sort of gets off on his own misery. I think that misery for people that are incredibly anxious or frightened is something consistent. I think obsession sometimes works as almost a spirituality. You have a routine that your brain kind of loops around that you call home. But that's usually in defense of some other part of you that's unruly. And for me, I think it's anxiety and panic and worry and dread.
Do you find that's true of most comics, that they have either depression, anxiety, dread, suffering that they have to escape from, and that comedy becomes the escape valve? And they found a way to talk about horrible things in a funny way, but it doesn't make the horrible things any less horrible necessarily.
I don't know. The reason it's hard for me to speak for comics in general, and certainly I've spoken to a lot of them, and certainly I initially thought that we all had to be miserable to be great comics. But as time goes on, I don't know that that's really the case. And what I found when I was a kid that really made me gravitate towards comedy was they seemed to have an angle on things. I think that comedy, when you're capable of it, it has a lot of uses. You can sort of disarm a situation. You can also, attack with a certain amount of clarity and finesse that may not be dangerous. You can protect yourself. You can, ease pain in others. I mean, it's a very, multifaceted tool and creative thing. So I don't know that it necessarily serves the same purpose for all comics, but I do know that for me, when watching comedy and also the way I do comedy is it puts an angle on things. You can get a handle on things in a very precise way, and it disarms a lot of that dread and panic.
So do you think of some of your dread and panic and anxiety? Let me back up and say Conan saw suffering as being a really Catholic thing. Do you see any of your dread and anxiety as being a Jewish thing?
I don't know. I think that if I'm to look at the history of Jewish education, just in the sense of, you know, where we're at culturally, there were always a sort of active engagement, you know, with arguing, with debating, with mulling things over, with putting it out there and getting a reaction, and even describing it, I'm getting more Jewy. And then you talk to the guy and he comes over and maybe you work something out. Maybe you don't. That's the way it goes. Not everything has closure. You know, maybe it's a little hard for me to characterize that, you know, without, you know, leaning on a stereotype that I'm not completely sure is true.
Comedian Marc Maron speaking with Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2013 interview with comic Marc Maron, who hosts the comedy interview podcast WTF. His TV series, Maron, returned this week on IFC. His memoir, Attempting Normal, is now out in paperback.
So I want to ask you about another podcast that you did. So you used to be really good friends with Louis C.K., the comic, who now has a TV show called Louis. You have a really terrific interview with him, and there's the double version podcast, and then there's the hour-long version on the Public Radio Exchange website, the PRX mm-hmm. website. So in this interview, part of it was about your relationship and how it kind of fell apart, and partially because you had gotten so resentful of his success. At least that's how I understood it from listening to the podcast. And I just want to play an excerpt in which you're talking to each other about the friendship. So Louis C.K. speaks first.
You don't have to put this in the podcast if you don't want to, but what I would say as far as trying to stay friends with somebody that you have a hard time thinking about what they're doing against what you're doing
yeah.
is focus on them needing a friend.
Yeah.
It takes a good friend to stay with you in hard times.
Yeah.
It takes a good friend to stay with you in good times. Everybody needs support. Yeah. Everybody does.
Yeah.
So you're letting me down. If you see me doing something and you have a hard time coming to terms with it because you're feeling about your own life, what's really happening is you're letting me down as a friend by being jealous.
Okay.
So think about the other person. Well, think about what they might need.
But in my heart...
I could have used you. I got divorced. I got a show canceled. You know, I had some tough times. I could have used a friend.
But you didn't.
Those times that were making you jealous, I was struggling. I was having a hard time.
But
doing the Louis show was really hard. Trying to keep my family together was hard.
But the thing is that in the way our friendship always operated, it was not that I was kept up to date in the day-to-day things. It wasn't a day-to-day call that we had. But it seemed that most of the time, the thing that made our friendship so deep and so strong was that when we did talk, we made each other feel better.
No, it's true, but you shut me out. You shut me out because you were having a hard time.
Okay, I apologize again.
Well, I apologize to you because I did it to you probably out of resentment.
Ignored
your emails because you ignored my phone calls back when there was no email.
Can we get back on track or what?
Yeah, I think we can.
Well, that's really an amazing piece of tape.
It's choking me up now. I mean, it's like, some of these podcasts I did, that was a while ago, you know, and there's an emotional intensity to that thing it's
real.
Heavy,
it just
man.
Sounds absolutely real. And
it was real. I don't listen to these things after I do them. And just hearing that, I'm like, oh my God, it was so loaded and intense. Well, that happened.
So how did the podcast change the relationship? It sounds like, okay, you tried to work it out. During the podcast, did you call each other afterwards? Did you go out for a cup of coffee?
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing about me and Louis is that when I went in to talk to him, I had all these memories of things like, you know, we're comics. So it wasn't like we were, you know, hanging out every day necessarily or taking vacations together with our girlfriends or wives or any of that. But with Lou, I had been certain junctures in his life that I thought were, you know, relevant to, you know, his growing as an artist. And it was just, it was a real issue for me. You know, I had a real problem with resentment. And, you know, Louis's his own guy. He's busy too, and he's got his own issues. But this thing happened. I think there was love there. We were good friends. We did have a connection. We did make each other, you know, feel better in times of crisis. And we just let it go. And it was a burden for me. So after that, yeah, we did. Yeah, honestly, you know, I the one thing I learned from that is a lot of times, because of the immediacy of the culture we live in, when you put a text out there or you shoot an email, it's like if you don't hear back from somebody in a day, you're like, well, that's it. What happened there? Why isn't he? And now that I'm a little busier, it took this to happen for me to realize it. Things fall through the cracks. You know, it's hard to keep up with everything that's coming at you. And, you know, ultimately what happened with him and I is, yeah, I went to New York and he invited me over to his house. You know, I ate leftovers and
very nice.
And we sat down and we talked for 2 hours. He showed me some cuts of one of the episodes he was working on and we connected and it was great. And then I went and did what I had to do. And he went and did what he had to do. And we're in touch. So, yeah, the friendship is intact and it's better.
Comedian Marc Maron speaking with Terry Gross last year. We'll hear more of their conversation in the second half of the show. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from America's Natural Gas. Learn how Florida Power & Light combines solar and natural gas to generate electricity 24 hours a day. Thinkaboutit.org. From Zillow. With homes for sale, historical pricing data, and photos available on Zillow.com or its family of apps. Zillow, find your way home. And from Angie's List, providing reviews of local roofers, painters, landscapers, and plumbers to keep the consumer informed. More at Angie'sList.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, David Edelstein reviews God's Pocket. It's the first film directed by John Slattery, who plays Roger Sterling on Mad Men. The movie stars Philip Seymour Hoffman in one of his final roles. Also, I'll review two new TV entries in the horror genre, Showtime's series Penny Dreadful and NBC's miniseries remake of Rosemary's Baby, and more with comic Marc Maron. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's 2013 interview with comedian Marc Maron. His memoir, called Attempting Normal, is now out in paperback. And season 2 of his IFC cable series, Maron, began earlier this week. Marin also hosts the popular podcast WTF, featuring his interviews with fellow comics. When we left off, we were talking about his podcast interview with Louis C.K., in which they reconciled after a long falling out. Marin admitted he'd been jealous and resentful of Louis C.K.'s success.
So, sometime after that podcast, he wrote a role for you in an episode of his TV series, Louis, which is based on his life. But in this episode, it's about the rift in your relationship. And in this episode, Louis has blamed you for the friendship falling apart. But he has this revelation that it was actually his fault. It wasn't your fault. It was his fault. So he goes over to your house to apologize. And I want to play the scene. And here's the conversation.
I realized that it was my fault completely. And it's like I was a total asshole to you. And I stopped being your friend. And I'm shocked now when I think of it. That I would ever have thought it was anything that you did. You did nothing, and I know that now, and I don't know how to look back at, you know, you look back at your actions, and man, I don't know if this has any meaning or worth to you, and I don't. Maybe this is just more of me being selfish, but I just want to say, Mark, that I'm sorry, and I wish that, I don't know what else to say.
Uh-huh. Okay, is that it, or?
Yeah, I guess so.
All right, well, I appreciate that, but I guess you don't remember, but you came over here 5 years ago and said the exact same thing.
I did?
Yeah, I mean, you cried that time. You didn't cry this time, so I guess that's something.
I kind of remember that now.
Yeah. Well, I accepted that time. I don't know this time, whatever. I don't know what you need something from me. Do you want?
No. I'm sorry.
Okay, again? All right.
Okay, I'm like.
Okay. Okay. We good then?
Yeah, man. I'm okay. Yeah.
It's all right. I mean, All
right. Well, I really am sorry though, just so you know.
Okay. I get it. It's okay. You know, it'd be really great though if maybe you call me up, you ask me for coffee, we go out to dinner.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. No, we'll do that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Or we could just do this again in 5 years.
Okay, man.
It's all right.
Okay.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
How you been? Good, man. That's very nice for you to ask. Okay?
All right, yeah.
All right.
That is so great. And I think just like hearing the actual conversation you had on your podcast and then hearing a similar story transformed into Louis' TV show, it's just a fascinating comparison. And what also I find so interesting is that Louis C.K. makes it all his fault in this. It's like,
it's not only his fault.
He's so kind of careless about the relationship. He doesn't even remember he apologized to you 5 years ago.
Yeah, and that's very Louis. I think he was being pretty honest in that exchange, and I think there was a lot of genuine emotion there. I think that on some part of him was a genuine apology. For what might have been his side of the selfishness in our relationship. I'm going to look at it that way because I feel that because he was definitely just listening. And as you know, when you just listen and you don't have any visuals, there's an emotional depth to it that I don't think I really heard until I just listened to that now when you played it.
So when I heard it, I was thinking, okay, so Louis C.K. is the main character in this and he's given the blame to himself. Because it's going to make it a more interesting episode, and because he's a generous guy, and so he's going to blame himself in his show and not blame you. But you think he's actually taken some of the blame for real in this?
Well, I think that these things are two-sided, and I think that when you listen to my podcast, that I could have pointed fingers, I could have been petty, and in that moment where I take responsibility for my side of it, I could have said but you this but you that but you, and I realized like that's not the time for it, understand and take the consequences of your actions. So I think there's a chance you would have to ask Louis if there was some part of him that was, you know, taking some responsibility, or maybe he was just, you know, created this role and did his riff on our riff and made it his own in that way. I don't really know. You'd have to ask him. But I do know that we are getting along better.
Good. I'm so glad to hear that. So you've mentioned that you think, in one of your podcasts, as I recall, you mentioned that you think a lot of comics have issues about their fathers. And you seem to. And I want to illustrate that with another clip. And this is a clip from your new IFC series, Marin. And this edition features Dennis Leary as the person you're interviewing in your podcast. And Dennis Leary is also actually, in real life, an executive producer of this new TV series. So in this show, which is episode 2 of your series, you've just done the podcast with Dennis Leary. And when it's over and you're leaving the garage, and the podcast is done from the garage in your house, he smells something foul coming from under your house. And it turns out there's a dead possum in the crawl space, but you don't know how to deal with it. And Dennis Leary has already accused you of not being a manly man. He said that you have too many Joni Mitchell records in your garage and you have too many cats. So you decide to get it together, and you kind of go out with your new assistant, your new intern, to get these kind of protective clothes and protective gloves and all this other gear so you can be a man and go down into this crawl space to get rid of the dead possum. But you really don't want to go. So you're standing right outside the crawl space and all of this protective gear with your intern by your side, and here's what you say.
Why can't I do this? Every other guy can do this. It's my dad's fault. He never showed me how to do this stuff. He never showed me how to throw a football. We never went camping. I can't fix anything. He was supposed to be around when I was a kid. He was supposed to show me how to do this crap. And then he just left with no explanation, no apologies, nothing. It was neglect, man. It was neglect and abuse.
I was molested at sleepaway camp.
What?
I'm sorry. I didn't mean for that to come out. I think I got caught up in your energy, and then it just... I don't think I've ever said that out loud before.
You want to talk about it?
No.
You sure? I'm here for you.
Yeah, no, I think it's a sit-down conversation problem.
Yeah, it's definitely a sit-down conversation.
That's my guest, Mark Maron, with Josh Brenner as his assistant, Kyle. I hope he has a steady part on the show.
He's funny. And that joke comes back around. It sounds a little gnarly just as it is, but you know, there's definitely a callback to that to the molestation setup there.
So anyways, I have to ask you: did you have a lot of issues with your father, and did he? Do you feel like he did not teach you to be a manly man?
I think that those issues there are a little exaggerated, but true. I think my father's biggest fault was that he was, you know, emotionally absent and actually absent a lot. I mean, he was around, but he wasn't really checked in. And, you know, he was a surgeon, so he was always out, you know, doing something that we were led to believe was, you know, life-saving and important. And when he was around, it was always, he was very, you know, either very manic or very... depressed. It was very erratic, and I think a lot of my issues are around that. I don't think that, you know, and I'm not whining. I think a lot of people can relate to this, that there wasn't a lot of support there. There was not a lot of guidance. I think there was just an expectation to kind of follow his lead, and if you didn't, you were some sort of idiot, or you know, he'd get mad. And there was not that active kind of moving through, you know, self development. If that makes any sense.
Did you ever become a hypochondriac to get his attention because he was a doctor?
How do you know that? Did you know that? Why did you ask me that? Where does that come from you? Why would you ask me that?
Why would I ask you that? Because it would be a way of getting attention. Because you say he was always going away to save people's lives. And yeah.
That's very perceptive and very that's why you're Terry Gross. I sometimes talk about it on stage. I went through a long hypochondria period. I mean, it was really, I can't believe you just sort of zeroed in on that. I recently told a story about how I finally got over that, the hypochondria with my father. I definitely had that.
How'd you get over it? Well, what did you do in the first place? I mean, what were some of the maladies that you had?
I always thought I was dying. You know, I always thought I was dying. And, you know, I would, you know, tell my father, you know, I think I'm this, I think I'm that. And when your father's a doctor, they can very easily get into a clinical mode with you and give you the attention you need, or, you know, tell you to go see their friend or take you. How I got over it was an awkward series of visits to his friend, you know, Bob, the urologist. you know, there was just a moment there. You know, on the fourth visit to this guy in one, you know, break from college, where I thought I had a number of things over the 3 week break. And I think I was on my fourth visit to Bob's office and I had my pants down and, you know, he was, you know, looking at me in a very, you know, there's a very specific, I don't know what I can say on NPR, but, you know, I had my pants down and Bob finally just said, you know, there's nothing wrong with you, Mark. Do you like coming here? And there was just something about that moment where I was like, you know, I you know, I'm going to have to think about that, Bob. And I think that this is the end of this period for me.
Comedian Mark Maron speaking with Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2013 interview with comic Mark Maron, whose TV series Maron returned this week on IFC. His memoir, Attempting Normal, is now out in paperback.
So you read in your book that your mother told you that you were a diaphragm baby, and you say, in my mind, that means I have an innate ability to overcome obstacles. But really, like, what impact did it have on you for your mother to basically say, we really didn't plan on having you, we had you anyways?
Yeah, I she doesn't hang on to that. There are bigger issues around the mother thing, you know.
Okay.
I felt, unfortunately, my grandparents, I was the first child and the first, you know, grandchild for, you know, all sets of grandparents. So I got a lot of attention there. And there was a couple things that my mother said to me that were more defining of what that relationship was. You know, not too long ago, you know, my mother is, you know, kind of a compulsively vigilant about her weight, and this is a very nice way to say a functioning anorexic. She's very proud of her weight. You know, she weighs 116 pounds, and I once wrote a piece for a cooking magazine that said she weighed 119 pounds, and it was as if I had misrepresented her entire life. She called me up and she goes, "How could you say that about me?" I'm like, "It's, what are you kidding me? It's 3 pounds." It's like, I am not 119. All right, so. But there are a couple of things that my mother said to me that, you know, recently where I'm like, oh, my God, maybe within the last 5 years, she kind of, you know, came up to me and goes, look, Mark, I got to be honest with you. I don't know if I could love you if you were fat. You know, and this was recently. And then the other time, maybe 3 years ago, she sits me down. I'm making Thanksgiving dinner down there. She goes, you know, Mark, you know, when you were a baby, I don't think I knew how to love you. And I'm like, all right, well, there's a missing piece to the puzzle that I guess I can cancel my therapy now, you know. So my mother's a character. There are other issues at hand. But, yeah, I mean, the diaphragm thing was the least of it.
Did you ever have a weight problem?
Well, according to her, I had a weight problem. I had a weight problem in that my mother, you know, basically, I think, taught me to read with calorie counting books, you know. I was a chubby kid and I had a mother who was, you know, just literally frightened of fat. She was an obese child and she just had this reaction to that she, you know, having been obese as a kid, it just scarred her, you know, forever. And, you know, and a lot of her life is dedicated to, you know, this maintenance of body image. And I grew up with that, you know, like being denied desserts being taken away. I've been, you know, saying on stage, which I don't know why it doesn't get a bigger laugh, because I think I framed it right. I said, you know, having this mother, I really think for like the first 9 or 10 years of my life, she just saw me as some kind of extension of her fat. And that if she just ate less, perhaps the kid would disappear, you know. And people always go, oh, and I'm like, I can't frame it any funnier. I mean, this...
Comedian Marc Maron speaking to Terry Gross last year. His TV series, Maron, appears Thursdays on IFC, and his memoir, Attempting Normal, is now out in paperback. Philip Seymour Hoffman, in one of his final film roles, stars as Mickey in God's Pocket, the new movie directed by John Slattery. Slattery is famous for his role as Roger Sterling on TV's Mad Men, and over the years has directed several episodes of that AMC series. He makes the transition to feature film directing with God's Pocket, which he and Alex Metcalf adapted from the 1983 novel by Pete Dexter. In addition to Philip Seymour Hoffman, God's Pocket features Richard Jenkins, John Turturro, and Slattery's Mad Men co-star Christina Hendricks. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
The title God's Pocket is a play on a South Philadelphia neighborhood of row houses known as the Devil's Pocket, though nowadays residents and realtors think that's in bad taste. But Pete Dexter wrote his novel in the early 80s and considered it one of the country's scariest neighborhoods, rife with poverty and gangsterism and alcohol-fueled brutality. Dexter doesn't write bleak sociological tragedies, though. For years, he was a Philadelphia Daily News columnist, and his prose is hard-boiled and morbidly funny. He is a nihilist. He never romanticizes the urban poor. But his characters have many dimensions, and they're hard to dislike. Director John Slattery has adapted the novel with Alex Metcalf and gets the tone just right. The movie is horrifying, but humanist, and I laughed all the way through it. I had to laugh or I'd have cried in despair. And the actors are a treat. Philip Seymour Hoffman is the hapless Mickey Scarpato, a trucker who mostly works for gangsters and is not a God's Pocket native. He married a widow, Jeannie, played by Christina Hendricks, but can't make her happy. Jeannie's son, Leon, is a near sociopath, and early on gets killed on a construction job. The crime is covered up by workers protecting their own, but Jeannie knows in her heart it wasn't an accident. So Mickey, trying to please her, makes inquiries. And so does a well-known newspaper columnist, Shelburne, played by Richard Jenkins, a lush who's instantly smitten with Jeannie. The sodden sap thinks he can take her away from all this. The movie has the structure of a sick farce. Leon's death sets a lot of things in motion. Maimings, shootings, beatings, even his corpse schlepped around in the back of a meat truck. After Leon's body disappears from the funeral home and ends up in the middle of a busy street amidst a lot of stakes, Jeannie wakes Mickey up by beating him with a newspaper.
In the paper.
What?
That Leon was killed again.
What? Why would they say that?
Because they found his body in the street. Why did they find his body in the street, Mickey?
I didn't have the money to pay to bury Leon, so I took the truck to Little Eddie's, but his guy took it out and wrecked it, and Leon fell out.
What?
Leon was in the truck.
No. With the meat.
He was separated from the meat. I knew that would upset you.
Philip Seymour Hoffman is heartbreakingly great. He's very heavy. He looks awful. We know with hindsight what he was going through in the last months of his life. But as an actor, he's all there. His Mickey is morose, out of his element, often stewed. But Hoffman is alert and transparent. Mickey is groping toward some kind of meaning he can't see. And I suspect that Hoffman was too. The hole in God's pocket is Jeannie. The idea is that she's so driven to find out who killed her only son that she acquiesces in a kind of stupor to the advances of the columnist Shelburne. She thinks he can help her. In Dexter's book, she makes some kind of sense, but on screen, she's a blank. What saves the scenes with Shelburne is Richard Jenkins, who gives the writer a touching obliviousness to his own dissolution. I'm not sure where the character came from, whether it was based on a columnist Dexter knew, or was his worst-case scenario of what he could become. But the man is both cringeworthy and hilarious. Slattery's handling of the rest of the cast is wonderfully indulgent. John Turturro gives one of his best performances as Bird, a desperate but hopeful screw-up, perilously in debt to mobsters. Eddie Marson is superbly clammy as the neighborhood funeral director, Smilin' Jack, feral under his civilized veneer. The scenes in the local watering hole are pitch perfect. Slattery has been typecast over the years as WASP senators and businessmen, among them, of course, Mad Men's Roger Sterling. But he's actually an Irish Catholic kid from a big working-class family, and he treats the tribalism here with affection. Many people will find God's Pocket depressing, but once you get past the despair and carnage, and yes, it's a lot to get past, it's full of life. The saddest thing is the reminder that Philip Seymour Hoffman is gone. There's no consolation for that.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Coming up, I review two new TV entries in the horror genre. The Showtime series called Penny Dreadful and NBC's miniseries remake of Rosemary's Baby. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Bianculli. This weekend, two very different TV productions attempt to do much the same thing. Revisit old works of literature in the horror and suspense genre and adapt them with new approaches for a new generation. NBC's four-hour miniseries version of Ira Levin's Rosemary's Baby barely justifies the attempt. Showtime's new series called Penny Dreadful, however, is much more captivating. Borrowing characters and ideas from several classic works of fiction, including Frankenstein and Dracula, and emerging with something refreshingly original. Rosemary's Baby, which begins Sunday and concludes Thursday, is neither refreshing nor original. It tries hard, too hard really, to stand apart from Roman Polanski's brilliant 1968 movie version. That film starred Mia Farrow as a woman who comes to fear that the child she's carrying was sired by the devil himself. In that movie, exteriors of the creepy New York apartment building where Rosemary and her husband lived, alongside some secretly satanic neighbors, were filmed at the Dakota, later famous as the building where John Lennon lived and was killed. For the TV remake, writers Scott Abbott and James Wong relocate the setting to Paris, where the architecture can be as gloomy, but the change seems unnecessary. And the leading role is given to Zoe Saldana, who played the blue-skinned alien in Avatar. She portrays Rosemary as a woman who's stronger and sexier than the one played by Farrow, but not a bit smarter. And where the movie had a meddling, mysterious old neighbor played by Ruth Gordon, NBC's Rosemary's Baby has a meddling, mysterious, elegant neighbor played by Carol Bouquet. Here they are in the kitchen.
What is this medicine?
Fertility soup. You drink it after it simmers for 12 hours in the clay pot.
Does it taste good?
No, terrible. But it will make you ready to have a baby. I learned this from the Chinese.
Some scenes are a bit bloodier this time around, but neither the parts nor the whole measure up to the original movie version of Rosemary's Baby. To be honest, I'm not sure why NBC has remade this at all. I can recommend Penny Dreadful, which starts Sunday on Showtime, a lot more enthusiastically. John Logan, screenwriter of the movies Hugo and Skyfall, sets this new series in London in 1891. Timothy Dalton, who once played James Bond, plays an intrepid explorer looking for his missing daughter. Eva Green, star of Tim Burton's recent remake of Dark Shadows, plays Vanessa Ives, a strikingly stunning woman who dresses in black and has her own hidden agendas and powers. They combine forces on a mission that takes them deep into London's underworld, a place less natural than supernatural. And in the premiere episode, after seeing a traveling Wild West show, Vanessa visits the star sharpshooter, played by Josh Hartnett, to try and enlist his services. He's eager to flirt, but she's all business.
So it's a job. This night work.
Yes.
Something of a criminal setup.
Would it matter?
Not at all.
Then why ask?
Show's heading off to Paris pretty soon.
The job's tonight.
Is it a murder?
Would it matter?
One smile and I say yes.
Meet me at this address at 11 o'clock.
I don't know London.
Then ask a policeman.
You have a name?
Yes.
Penny Dreadful makes room very quickly for characters from Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, Bram Stoker's Dracula, and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, but in ways that seem fresh rather than forced. Showtime's Penny Dreadful is scary, seductive, surprising, and smart. Everything that NBC's Rosemary's Baby is not. Penny Dreadful is just wonderful. Rosemary's Baby is just dreadful. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. John Sheehan directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Radius, presenting Fed Up, a new documentary from the producer of An Inconvenient Truth, examining what's in the food Americans are eating, now in theaters. From Arizona State University, with more than 60 campus degrees, now available 100% online at online.asu.edu. And from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, with a diagnostic exam and treatment plan for advanced stage patients seeking a second opinion at cancercenter.com. This is NPR.
On the next Fresh Air, how the government came to spy on millions of Americans. We talk with Michael Kirk, director of the new PBS Frontline documentary, United States of Secrets. It tells the history of the NSA's data collection program and the government's attempts to keep it quiet. We'll also hear from two former NSA analysts who were interviewed in the documentary. Join us.